Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Robert McFarlane has this lyrical, meditative writing style that helps him convey his deep engagement with the natural world. He's written about mountains and forests and caves and root systems, and his books are chronicles of his journeys to these places. And often he's working through a question. Now, this latest question is the title of his new book, Is a River Alive? It's about three rivers in a cloud forest in Ecuador, in southeast India, and in the deep wilderness of Quebec. But he begins the book and that question at a chalk stream not far from his house in Cambridge, England.
A river is born twice. One of those births is always ongoing. That is the spring that feeds the river that seeks the sea. And that's a continuous process. But there's a second birth, and that's the singular birth that a river has in time.
12,000 years ago, a river is born. In a hollow at the foot of a hill on which flints lie white as eyes, water rises for the first time from a crack in the chalk and flows away.
I live a mile from this little spring, the waters of which run through the pages of my life. And I, at some point, just realized, I want to know when that river was born. The one-off birth, the deep time birth. And so I began following the threads back.
This spring water fell first as snow. It settled, melted, seeped slow through the bedrock, then surfaced here as a spring. A sleepless flutter of silver movement, rippling the pool it has made with whispers and mutters.
Between 10 and 12,000 years ago, Cambridge was in the grip of permafrost. So the river was born when the temperature raised enough that rain or snow melting, falling, could begin to seep down into the rock and could fill the aquifer, could charge the earth as groundwater, and eventually build up the pressure necessary to emerge as a spring.
Spring becomes stream, becomes river, and all three seek the sea.
And so that spring has been flowing more or less continuously for the best part of 12,000 years. And I suddenly realized that when you center water in a landscape, flowing water, you realize what a powerful historical agent it has been. We know that hunter-gatherers were drawn there to cook and to nap flints. The Neolithic causeway was built there. A huge Iron Age ring fort was built close to the springs. Bronze Age burials. Then the Romans came. Then the breakup of the Roman Empire in the so-called Dark Ages. All the way, continuously through, to the emergence of Cambridge. And then we reach the summer of 1976, which was the summer I was born, though I take no credit or blame for what happened that summer, which was a drought so severe, so hot, so fierce that we haven't actually known the like since. And that dried up the spring. And finally, then in the early 2000s, I moved to the area, became a father for the first time and discovered the springs, as it were. I mean, just for myself. And became fascinated by them and have been drawn back and back and back to them over 20 years. And in the summer of 2022, which is the summer I really began writing the book, was the hottest global summer on record. The summer when all the rivers nearly died.
One day, late in the long dry, I walk up to the springs with my younger son, Will. I know what we will find that day, and I cannot quite understand why we are going. The springs have almost perished. Over-abstraction from the aquifer and a series of arid summers have done their preparatory work, and now the drought has struck. I've never seen the main pool so low. The hollow is choked and rank with leaves, There's less than an inch of water in the stream bed that leads from the springs, and no perceptible flow. Has the water died? Asks Will.
It's such a piercing question, isn't it? Can a river die? And I think actually we find it easier to recognize that water can die, that a river can die, because we know what it looks like and we know what it feels like. But I didn't want to tell Will that because he was 9 and it hurt him. He knew something was wrong there. And I remember we left the wood and there was an egret and it was standing there in the outflow from the springs near the exit to the wood. But it was standing on dry ground, dreaming that the water was still flowing. So that little set of encounters became very foundational. Is the water dead? Well, no, it will come back, should come back, but we can kill rivers.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Robert McFarlane is with us for the hour. Is a river alive is actually one of 3 questions that came to him a few years ago. He also wrote down in his notebook, can a forest think? Does a mountain remember? And they're all connected by a theme, how we relate to the natural world and what it means to imagine it as alive.
They all press at the limits of how we describe, recognize, and attribute something like being.
Right.
So, you know, according to a lot of very powerful intellectual currents, life stops broadly with the human, and certainly matter, broadly understood, is inanimate. Can a forest think? I mean, of course, it depends what you mean by think. Well, we now know that forests are collectives of trees that exist in, and other plants that exist in, complex forms of cooperation, collaboration, and competition. Is that thinking? Well, it asks about our models of cognition. So each of them presses hard at the limits of language, at the limits of how we imagine self, mind, other, and above all, I think, being. And to me, being is a verb.
The times you've asked those 3 questions in your work and then gone on journeys to work out the question, you've talked about how they all began in doubt, that it wasn't clear, the answer. Why is that important?
Well, otherwise I would just be showing my workings, right? I would already have finished the equation. And no one wants to read workings. They're the bits that no kid wants to do in homework, and no teacher wants to mark them, no reader wants to read them. So this is not a book called A River is Alive or A River Has Rights. It's a book called Is a River Alive? And although all my books have been motivated by questions, that the last one, Underland, the question at the heart of that is, are we being good ancestors? Mm-hmm. But I think exploration is fundamental to me, and it's an intellectual as well as a physical undertaking. So I wanted to really test my own imagination by contact with people and places and rivers and ideas and conversations that did not all say yes to the question, is a river alive? Some of them did, and the ways they said yes to it interested me as well, but others were resistant to it, and the rivers were there as well as co-thinkers, co-writers, and I non-trivially mean that they co-authored this book, co-thought this book.
I want to ask you about the language that we use. You mentioned this was in April of 2021, and 4 women from this intertribal coalition had written this letter to then President Joe Biden advocating for Bears Ears, that piece of land. And you include in the book some of this letter. And I want you to read that first sentence, because this is the crucial sort of bit that I want to ask you about. This is how they put it. They're writing about how we know these lands as a mother knows her child, but they begin by writing, we relate to these lands who are alive. And it's that who part that caught your attention.
Yeah. Language is one of the great geological forces of the Anthropocene. We tell stories with it. It determines where we where we break ground, where we mine, how we relate to land, to creatures, to one another. So, I mean, in a sense, yeah, language, everything happens within language. But there are two things going on in that. These lands who are alive. So first of all, we have the confrontation, not to the mind of the writers of the letter, but to our minds, at least I surmise, lands being alive, lands alive. Well, life in the lands, creatures in the lands, but the lands themselves. So there's that confrontation, which is a version of the is a river alive question. And then there is who. Yeah, who? These lands, who? Now, what happens when we who land or when we who a river, without wanting to sound too much like Dr. Seuss, we recognize in that particle of language, we recognize a person. And I don't mean a human person. I mean another presence that expands the category of person. You know, what we speak in language, we often reproduce in power, as it were. So river as resource, the river which flows, river as life force, the river who flows.
One of the places where you go to ask this question is Ecuador. And I wanted to talk about what Ecuador does so remarkably. I think it was 2008, where they create legislation with all of the typical kinds of legalese that raises, and I think that process of the writing of this document, or the section anyway, that proposes nature has rights. Would you take us through this process and what they do there?
Yes, and it doesn't propose it, it declares it. Yeah, this is a non-propositional document. This is a constitution. So in 2007, Rafael Correa, the as it were, socialist president, comes to power in Ecuador, along with a whole bunch of other leftist presidents in the pink tide down in Latin America at that time. And one of the first things he does is basically rip up the existing constitution and gather an assembly to revise the constitution. And he doesn't give them long. He gives them, like, I think it's 9 months or something. Come up with an entirely new blueprint for running a nation state. And this incredible process gets underway. It's an absolute whirlwind of, you know, interested parties and lobbying and groups trying to imagine, and I call it moral imagination. They're trying to imagine otherwise how a nation state might function differently to the ways it's proceeded up to that point. So there's a lot of work on the right to water, for example, and there's work on indigenous rights, a very strong sort of trans-tribal indigenous group. They organized very well at this time. But the articles of the Constitution that have caught the global imagination then and continue to do so are the Articles 71 to 74, and these are the so-called rights of nature articles. And the first of those recognizes the right of nature, the rights of nature, to exist, to flourish, and to persist, and to continue to do that in the future. And the fourth of those, I won't go through the other two, but the fourth of those makes the state the guarantor of those rights, which is to say that theoretically, and indeed practically, a citizen can bring a case to the Constitutional Court, if it gets that far up, against someone or something, a corporation, say, that is seen to be violating the rights of the river or the forest, or the river and the forest, of nature broadly understood. And that's pretty radical. Indeed, it's hugely radical.
You describe it as moral imagination, that Ecuador had the moral imagination to drop this idea about rights for nature. Does the United States, does the UK, do they lack that moral imagination? Like, what are the characteristics of it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. North America and the US is actually the hotbed of rights movements and, let's say, moral imagination. And there's a wonderful example. The story of the Klamath River flows down out of Oregon and into California and reaches the sea. And the Klamath, as you will know, has been the site of the biggest de-damming project in US history. And the de-damming project, which concluded the dismantling late summer, early fall, was the result of a powerful act of moral imagination pioneered by the Yurok tribe, who were a salmon people, but who could no longer be salmon people because the dams that went up there from the 1920s onwards, 1922 is the first, the four big dams, had stopped the salmon run. So for about 20 years, I think even longer, the Yurok tribe and a wider alliance of, you know, river keepers, effectively, river dreamers, imagined otherwise. Mm. And they imagined a free river, a river without those dams. And what would that look like? And what would the watershed look like? And what would life look like and feel like and smell like? And amazingly, they won those arguments and the dams came down at, you know, big cost. But the speed with which the river has revived and the watershed has revived, the life that has poured back, the salmon run is already reinvigorating itself. A century, salmon couldn't get past the first dam that went up to the headwaters to spawn, but they must have kept trying, because within days of the Iron Gate Dam coming down, the first Chinook salmon was caught on sonar heading upstream.
Robert McFarlane. He's a fellow at the University of Cambridge, where he teaches literature and environmental humanities. His latest book is called Is a River Alive? We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer and naturalist Robert McFarlane. In his latest book, he asks the question, is a river alive? McFarlane goes on these journeys to find people who think that rivers are not resources, but they're living beings and they have actual legal rights. He says if a river dries or recedes or becomes choked with pollution, it's a failure of moral imagination. And this is a conversation that is very relevant to this place. What changes if we consider a river, or in our case, a lake, to be alive? The book is called Is a River Alive? Let's get to the first journey that you write about in the book. Trip to northern Ecuador and the cloud forest and rivers there. Tell us about Juliana, this remarkable human being. She's the kind of the first main character, great character in the book, a book with a lot of great characters, I have to say, who share this kind of remarkable experience with grieving that we can talk about in a moment. But tell us about her first, and maybe you could just talk about her ability to hear or sense fungi.
Late one day in March 2017, while driving a rough road through a monkey puzzle and beech forest in southern Chile, with sleet spattering the windscreen, Juliana suddenly screeched to a halt. She had seen something she later described as a fuzz in the matrix on the exposed black earth on the left bank of the road. A difference, a glitch. She jumped from the car. There, growing among tree roots on the tangled bank, was a mushroom with a pitch-black cap flecked with small white scales, and another, there, and another, six of them, six black and white mushrooms growing in that snowy undercut.
Juliana Furci is the founder of the Fungi Foundation. She is a hardcore Chilean, Italian, British mycologist, fungi specialist. She's written the two definitive field guides to the fungi of Chile, which is where she lives and works predominantly. So, you know, first of all, we're talking about a very serious person, somebody hugely accomplished in the world and a very remarkable field mycologist who knows the taxonomies and the cellular level biology inside out. She's hardcore.
Right.
But she also senses fungi in ways that I find impossible to assimilate within the bounds of the natural, in ways that seem supernatural. But I guess one might say that they're a sort of form of internalized knowledge, as manifested as instinct. But however you rationalize it, what happened is when she was driving. I wasn't with her at this point. When she was driving down a dark road in Patagonia with Cosmo and Merlin Sheldrake, our mutual friend, she suddenly pulled the vehicle over, disappeared off into the forest. Cosmo and Merlin heard a kind of whoop from deep in the forest, went over with their phone torches, and there Juliana was flat on her belly, which is how she likes to greet fungi. And woohoo is her kind of greeting to fungi. And there were, I think they're called Stephanopus azureus, but basically they're blue. Yeah. They're a spectacular blue species. And Cosmo and Merlin were like, what? I mean, this was, you know, the car was out of sight, deep in the woods. Like she was deep in the woods, and she just said, "Oh, I heard them. I heard them. I knew they were there." And one off would seem, you know, amazing but implausible. But it happened twice in the cloud forest. We'd gone to the cloud forest in part to fortify the orthodox protection of that forest by seeking and finding and making second collections of two fungal species, both psilocybe, i.e. magic mushrooms, as people know them, psilocybin. So we went looking as part of this bigger expedition to Los Cedros, the cloud forest that was saved by the Rights of Nature ruling, and she found them. She found them both. In both cases, they were a single brown witch-hatted mushroom in an immense hectareage of cloud forest on a forest floor which was predominantly brown with leaf litter. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, she heard them before she saw them. We would go three turns of the path and then woohoo, and down she goes like she's been shot or a howler monkey has wanged something onto her head. But no, there's the single tiny 2-inch high mushroom, and she greets it. She photographs it. She then samples it very carefully according to, you know, best collecting protocol, places it in a box containing silica gel, which is what dehydrates it without deforming its structure and appearance. And one of them has since been named, and the other turned out to actually be a slightly different genus, but one which had somehow internalized psilocybin DNA within itself. So that has then just sort of complicated that little branch of the web of life a little bit further. And both have also helped fortify the environmental protections for the cloud forest, which remains very threatened because gold prices of which were incredibly high when we went in 22 are now obviously through the roof thanks to tariffs and Ukraine and all the rest of it. So the forest holds gold and the mining companies continue to circle.
Before we get to Canada, let's talk about India. In the second part of the book, Chennai, a city of three rivers, and they're dying, as you put it in the book. Industry is destroying those rivers. Talk about what's happening here and your idea to basically trace those rivers from inland to coast.
Yeah, so Chennai is Southeast India. Tamil Nadu is the state, famous in part for its immense coastline. The beach at Chennai runs for miles and miles and miles, and sea turtles have been hauling themselves up there and laying their eggs for hundreds of thousands of years, and humans have been living by water at or near that coast for tens of thousands of years. An earliest kind of hominin river presence is traced back to about 1.5 million years. So it's a water region of immense age. It also suffers, what would we say, like famine and feast. So for much of the year, it's desperately stricken by drought, and the poorer parts of the city are served only by standpipes and by plastic bottle water, which is its own kind of catastrophe. And then the river returns monstrously during particularly the monsoon, but especially the cyclone season. So every few years, Chennai is devastatingly flooded by these rivers. And the rivers are called from north to south. I think it goes the Kosastalaya, the Adya, and the Kuam. And for parts of the year, for parts of their lengths, those rivers are as close to dead as any water body I've ever seen. So 0% dissolved oxygen, that's the free-floating oxygen, not the oxygen that's bound into the H2O, and zero species count. I call the chapter Ghosts, Monsters, and Angels, and the ghosts are the rivers and the water bodies where they've been built on and killed and suppressed and forgotten and erased even from maps. the monsters and the forms those that water takes when the cyclones come, and the angels are the remarkable people who are working for a just future for water and people and creatures in that city. And one of those is this young man called Yuvan Arvids, who had been a friend for several years and is the kind of Juliana of that chapter, as it were. He became my, you know, my guide, my friend, my interpreter. And we followed those rivers as best we could in stages, as it were, from inland down through the city to the sea.
Rivers run through Yuvan too. Water is what he both thinks about and thinks with. It is the substance that defines both his landscapes and his ductile, fast-flowing mind. Faced with the slow violence visited upon the rivers of his city, Yuvan reimagines how water might be. Faced with conditions in which the life-giving powers of rivers have been forgotten or erased, he works to reanimate new old ways of seeing and listening to them. All stories from Chennai must contain the rivers and the sea and their many forms of agency, he has written. And if they do not, there is surely something missing.
You say Yuvan, water is both what he thinks about and thinks with. Say a little bit about his life experience. I mean, he runs away from home. He lets nature teach him about nature. As a young man, I guess. Is that how to put it?
Yeah, well, he ran away. I mean, he ran away from home because he had been physically abused for years by his stepfather. Really, I mean, he's very open about this. So he ran away at 16, you know, sort of shell of a boy, really. He began to reimagine himself, and he did so by running to a what's called a Krishnamurti school, called Pashala, inland of Chennai. And there he lived and he studied and he thought with the creatures and the books and the teachers and the pupils. So it was like a web of life began to surround him. And he taught himself, I mean, what we might call snake wrangling. I mean, he's a brilliant snake handler. He also became a field naturalist of staggering inclusivity. I mean, working across the kingdoms, which is what he does, he is the best field naturalist I've ever worked and walked with. Just spectacular knowledge in his home landscape. But and I watched him take snakes from the trees, and I mean, they're friends. They're all friends. He has this deep and abiding love of what in Tamil is called paluye, which means all of life.
The experience that you write about being on the turtle patrol. Would you take us through that? I think that there's this, I don't know if this gives something away that you don't. It's a lovely sort of coda to this moment, but you're toiling away. And then there's this nice moment, that maybe you can talk about. I just thought as a scene, this was exciting and lovely.
Yeah. So Olive Ridley sea turtles, what astonishing creatures they are. These mothers, and they're all mothers who come ashore at Chennai in January, February, early March. And they come ashore over the months in their thousands. And they come ashore alive and they come ashore dead. And they come ashore dead because these mothers who journey for hundreds, thousands of miles through the deep, following incredible ancient instincts and map-making technologies we can only even begin to comprehend. They know where that beach is, even if they've been swimming off, you know, deep in the Indian Ocean. They know where to go at that time of year, and when they wash up dead, they do so because they've been struck by trawler or tangled in ghost nets as they approach the beach. And so we walked that beach in the day, and it stank of rotting turtle meat, and the eyes of the turtles get picked clean by the ghost crabs, and it's the cycle of life and death, and it's also humans killing where they don't need to. But at night, the turtles come ashore to alive to lay their eggs. And they've been doing this for, well, probably millions of years. And they know what to do. they hole themselves up in the dark. They dig, the mothers dig, dig a nesting hole with their flippers effortfully. We all kind of know what this looks like. We've seen it on the TV programs. And then they drop their eggs in there, sometimes 100, 120 ping pong ball shaped eggs. And then they cover them back over and then they slip back out to sea and leave them. And for a long time, that was fine. That was a way, that was safe. And the hatchlings, when the hatchlings come up 40 odd days later, they know to make for the beach. Mm. But now the beach is a dangerous place. So many, you know, the city has grown. So there are feral dogs that dig out the nests. There are tractors pulling the fishing boats that collapse the nests and crush the eggs. The turtle hatchlings get pulled inland by the bright lights of the city, which they think are the moon or they think are sea sparkle. But of course, if they go inland, they die. So the numbers are really, really challenging. So the turtle patrol for 20 years, more, 30 nearly, every night during breeding season, they walk the beach, miles and miles of beach, spread out, and they watch the mothers come ashore, or they track their tracks. They dig out the nests, they count the nests out, they count the eggs out of the nest, and then they move them in thousands and thousands and thousands of eggs to a safe hatchery space on the beach where they get reinterred in the sand, exactly the same nest shape, exactly the same number of eggs. So there's no mixing of hatches. It's all very, very organized. And then 40 days later, that sand starts to kind of shuffle and hiss and bubble, and out come the hatchlings from that clutch of eggs. And I was there not only to spend the night humbling, exhausting, deeply moving night, digging out the nests and carrying them safely to the sand to be reinterred. But I was also there when the first hatchling of the season popped out of the sand, and there was a big cry went up from everyone. And this tiny little child's toy miniature, perfect miniature of a vast sea turtle was there. And all it wanted to do was get into the water. Life, life.
Let's talk about Canada, which is the final journey. Why did you choose this one? We'll get to Wayne in a moment, who's an extraordinary character, like a lot. And Rita, too, we have to talk about. Tell us what took you to northeastern Quebec?
Well, in each of these three places, Ecuador, Chennai, Quebec, Nitassanan, there were rivers under threat from mining in Ecuador, from pollution in India, and from damming in Quebec, Nitassanan. But in each of these places, rivers were being radically reimagined as well. The rights of the forest and the rivers in Ecuador, the angelic dreaming of a just future for water in Chennai, and indeed rights again in this anti-damming campaign that resulted in the Mutesikoushipu, or the Magpie River, the one at the heart of this section, being become the first Canadian river to have its rights recognized and to be declared a living entity. And this took the form of a mirror, what's called a mirror resolution, which is where two matching resolutions, each differently slightly inflected and worded, were issued by the Mingani Regional Council, the White Council, and then the Innu Council at the little township of Equanish. And it was Rita Mestikosho, this Innu community leader, who helped draft the Innu version of that. And it's an amazing, and again, another amazing document. And so I traveled to meet that river to ask Rita's permission to descend it, to be dropped by float plane about 100-120 miles up the system, yeah, and then to paddle out through roadless terrain to the sea at the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And I think I can confidently say I've taken a few journeys in fairly remote places in my time, but this was the most powerful and consequential I've ever known, probably ever will.
Robert McFarlane, his latest book is called Is a River Alive? We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer and naturalist Robert McFarlane. We're talking about his book, Is a River Alive? You say in the book that you don't remember when you first met Wayne, but you do know, this is how you put it in the book, his mind is one of the two or three most unusual you've ever encountered. Sounds like incredible memory. There was a 400-line poem that he could basically go through with hardly a hitch. Tell us about Wayne.
Well, human dictaphone to start with. Like people keep asking me, how did you reconstruct these conversations between you and Wayne? And I say, oh, I had a secret technology. And they're like, oh, right. Did you just keep the iPhone running all the time? I was like, no, I kept Wayne running.
Right.
We would literally have these conversations. And then when we'd finish them, I'd say, Wayne, would you mind just reconstructing that and speaking it back into my phone while I record it? So they would then just reel off this sort of 15-minute hyper-philosophical, ultra-technical, nerd conversation that we both just had about river ontology or something, or how we were going to paddle the next day or something. And he can do it. Yeah, he started reciting a 300-400-line poem to me, and he stumbled for the first time at line 212 or something, and he was so mad with himself. So he's superhuman memory. He thinks about the world in always counterintuitive. I sometimes say he picks the world up by its trouser cuffs and sort of turns it upside down and shakes it to see what change will fall out of its pockets. And that change is always thought, takes the form of thought. So, that's Wayne.
Let's talk about Rita, finally. You ask her permission to follow the river, and she just laughs.
Yeah, she laughs. Well, I asked her permission, obviously, because I'm a white dude, and can I get dropped by a float plane on the river that's flowed through your people's traditions for 8,000 years? And so, of course, if she'd said no, I would have turned around and retraced the 4-day journey that I'd made to get to that place. I would have obeyed her instantly. But she said yes. She laughed at me. She said, yeah, you don't need my permission. You need the river's permission. And she also, but she, Rita, so yeah, Innu poet writes in Innu and French. I'm in the Innu language and French. And just a absolute force of a presence, singer, altar community together, guards her the Innu Aymen language. It's really endangered. Stunning poet. If anyone of your listeners has French, find Atiku Utai, Le Coeur du Caribou by Rita Mestacosho. Absolutely astonishing. She's a Governor General Award winner. She's, she's incredible. And
would you say something about the characteristics of the poetry? I was interested. You flow matters to her, you say, and that there's in that collection that you mentioned, not one of those poems has a full stop anywhere in it.
Yes. Yeah, she's not a full stop person, Rita. Well, I say that, but she's also very decisive. Yeah, she writes, she writes sometimes in Innu Aymen, sometimes in French, sometimes in both what's called macaronic poetry, where you effectively a poem contains a line in one language and then a line in the other, and they mutually translate. Mm. But her poetry is, I suppose, it's about her love of land and water, about memory, about her people, the Innu people, and how they're, their lives had been profoundly changed by the arrival, obviously, of European colonizers. And what's this? There's a first line of one of her incredible poems. It says, mes peuples écrivaient des dictionnaires de la terre, I think is how it begins. So my people used to write dictionaries of the land. Mm. She goes on, encyclopédie des rivières, encyclopedias of rivers. And it's the tense that matters. I think when I first translated it, I think I translated it as my people wrote, but actually I think it's more powerfully translated and truly translated as my people used to write. So there's a sense in which that has been taken away from them by settlement and all of it.
Yeah.
So Rita lives in surprising powers of hope, I think. But she primed me for the river. She absolutely got me ready with a series of
Well, that's what I want to talk about, finally. So one of the things she says to you, she gives you these instructions, really remarkable. The first thing she says, one of the things she says is, Robert, I would say this, don't think too much with your head. Forget your notebooks on the river. Leave them behind. And then the first thing you write after that is you gulp. So I'm just trying to imagine, as a writer who I'm guessing fills up lots of notebooks as you're trying to remember, what did you make of that instruction and how did you try to follow it?
It pierced me to the soul. I mean, actually, so she got me bang to right. She was like, you look too much with your eyes. You think too much with your head. You don't feel enough with your heart. You think in hierarchies. You need to think like the river. I said, well, how do I do that, Rita? I've been trying to do that for the last 3 years and I don't think I'm any closer. And, the notebooks, I came to a negotiated settlement with her. I was like, Rita, I have to have these notebooks. She said, well, if you have to have them, then you must promise me you will only write when you're on land. Right. You mustn't write in them when you're on the water. And that was brilliant. And what she was doing, I realized in this amazing, intuitive and decisive way, was just stripping away all my usual mediations, my usual props, my, you know, oh, I'm the writer, I'm standing on the bank, I'm watching everything happen, I've got a pen behind my ear, a notebook in my hand. But also I analyze, I rationalize, I'm optical. Seems like, no, you get rid of what, you leave that here. You just switch it off, toggle it off. And of course that's hard to do, but in the end, the river really, really did it to me, the river and Rita. So she was incredible. She is a force like a river. She rivers you when you meet her. I watched her heal a woman while singing these extraordinary songs, just, you know, almost as you and I might, I don't know, run a glass of tap water and have a drink. Very matter of fact about it.
She says, she tells you to fast. She tells you to pitch your tent facing east. There's the moment that I want to talk about was the experience of going over the rapids of the river. And I want to ask about, one of the things you write about at this point is how there's this thrumming in your body. I don't know if it was fear, what it was. I mean, it's terrifying. And I have to say, it sounds a little crazy that you did it. The water, this water in particular, when you're going down, it's 6 feet higher than in summer. Describe it as this swollen current with these crashing sharp shields and plates of ice that are there. You mentioned the fear slithering down your throat. Like, what, as we talk about what happens, just give us your sense of how you're thinking about this moment and whether you can do this or should do this.
Well, Iris Murdoch, the moral philosopher novelist, she says, at the moment of choice, the business of choosing is almost always all done. And I think it's a stunning insight, because I think what she's saying there is we dupe ourselves when we think ourselves rational beings. And we also dupe ourselves when we represent moral choice, particularly, or consequential choice, as happening at a moment where you can assess, you know, all the possible consequences of the right fork in the road or the left fork in the road. He says, no, 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 no. The reason you take the left or the right fork is because of so many things that the river has been flowing, the river of choice has been flowing all that time. And we think that choice is choice, but actually choice is choosing, and choosing is a chronic matter. It unfolds over time. Anyway, that's all a preamble to say, shouldn't have run this rapid. 6 foot high standing wave, surrounded by endless other standing waves. Decided I wasn't going to do it. And then the light changed. The sun came out briefly, flicked across my face. And then I was like, all right, let's do it. And, you know, I look back on that. I said, what changed? Is it just the sun made me feel stronger and braver? Or was, I have no idea. But we ran it. And the language there is, you know, everything's getting rivered by this point. My thought, my language, my metaphysics, my body, hell, my body, my old body. So yeah, then the river takes over the book.
Everything is chaos. Four of the five boats are belly up, and I strike out and somehow traverse the current that's rushing me downstream. And there are rocks under my hands, then under my elbows, then under my knees. And I haul myself out onto the rocks and lie there face down, gulping like a landed fish, then roll over onto my back and shout laugh at the sky, which is now flooded with a late day stormlight.
I think it's so interesting. There's a question. Rita says you could ask the river one question. And it's such an intimate, abstract moment. We don't even need to say much about it. I think readers will encounter it in a really fascinating way. But one of the things you've said is over the course of the book, I'm not sure if it culminates here, but you say language began to liquefy, and you mention how the river's tongue became the tongue of tongues. You don't have to, of course, say what question came to you, but explain how you were thinking. You describe having this unmistakable sense of some kind of incandescent aura. I don't want to overdo it, but do you mind talking about this?
I will, though tentatively, and I will say that that what happened to me, or what I experienced there at the gorge in the very final pages of the book, felt like a kind of epiphanic event that I realized afterwards could never have come into being, could never have happened had it not been for all the years of river journey and river people and river ideas. So it was both something that unfolded over a long period of time, but seemed to happen very acutely in the moment. But and I suppose I say all that partly because I think it will only really make sense to the reader if they themselves take the journey of the book and reach that point at where the tributaries all converge. So even the phrase incandescent aura, as you understand, you're like, I don't want it to be too much. Mm-hmm. And it feels too much when you just meet it as a, so I suppose I'll say that it's kind of the, well, the book has two endings, and both of them astonished me, because I had not seen either of them coming. And one of them is what happened at the gorge, and the other is what happened a little while after that back at the springs. And in both, I will say that I have never before, and I suspect never will subsequently, have the feeling of being spoken through or written through or sensed through by a force, a non-human force, let's say, a presence much, much greater than myself. And I give that the name river, but other people might give it the name God or earth or land or the universe having a human-shaped experience, as someone put it to me. So, yeah, well, I think each person will find a version of their own way of being in the world in what happened there.
It is that there's so much there, death, and as you say, toward the end, and love, and then life, and all of those things. And I won't give up the final image that you offer. As you, it's a beautiful image with your imagining with your children there. But it seems awfully hopeful. Is that a way to put it?
Well, I'm fascinated by how people meet the epilogue, the very final page and a half. And quite a few people are finding it hopeful, and others, I mean, my mum keeps reading it and then bursting into tears. Wow. And then reading it again and then bursting into tears again. And, I mean, obviously my mum has a particular perspective. I'm like, Mum, you don't need to read it again. It's fine. but I don't know. I think that, let me, end by saying this, that I think the job of a writer, or no, that's the job is the wrong word for it. The dream of every writer who writes about land and water and place and people, the world, the given world, is that you find a way of naming and honoring the world in itself, in its own right, utterly itself, and setting that world ringing as an image, as a metaphor, as a myth, as something that resonates beyond itself. So we could say that you need to find ways of letting matter be metaphoric and metaphor be material. And another way, the other way I've come to think of it is that place itself, water itself, nature itself needs to be both the substance that is set ringing and the instrument that strikes and sets that resonance going. And I think the end of this book is probably the closest I've got to letting both Clapper and Bell sing.
Robert McFarlane, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Robert McFarlane, he's a fellow at the University of Cambridge, where he teaches literature and environmental humanities. His latest book is called Is a River Alive? Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.